This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the landscape of political comedy has shifted in recent years. We'll talk to the author of a new book that argues it's important to pay attention to what the other side of the political aisle thinks is funny. Now, one of the most talked about issues in this year's midterm election campaigns has been election laws themselves. In Wisconsin, Governor Evers vetoed nearly 20 election-related bills passed by Republicans in the legislature over the last 2 years, covering things like absentee voting, election funding, and more. His challenger, Republican Tim Michaels, vows to revive those bills if he's elected governor. Also up in the air is the fate of the state's bipartisan elections commission. Voting procedures are getting challenged in courts around the country, a potential preview of lawsuits to come after the November elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What voting issues do you want to hear candidates talking about? Do you want voting laws in Wisconsin changed in some way? Do you worry about them being too loose or tightening up too much? And how about the impact of false claims about voter fraud and how it's affected our conversations about election laws? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Robert Yablon is an associate professor of law and co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative at the UW Law School. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
So big issues here in Wisconsin, and we're hearing a lot of voting challenges, debate about laws around the country. How did this become such a big issue in 2022?
Well, you know, big picture, the idea that election law itself would be an election issue is not completely unprecedented. I mean, it's been an issue at times throughout our history, whether you're talking about voting rights for women or people of color, if you're talking about redistricting and gerrymandering or campaign finance laws. But these controversies ebb and flow, and it does seem like over the past couple of years, we've been in the midst of a bit of a perfect storm. And a lot of that is an outgrowth of the events of 2020, where you had former President Trump refusing to accept defeat, insisting that the election had been rigged and stolen. And he and his allies are continuing to beat that drum to this day. And when you combine that with the fact that our political system has become as polarized as it's been in generations, and you combine that with the fact that we have states like Wisconsin that are very close. And so there is an incentive to fight about every election rule in an attempt to get any possible edge. You really see, you know, these election law issues coming to the fore.
Now, I mentioned a bunch of bills passed by Republicans in the legislature, vetoed by Governor Evers. A change either in the governor, if Republicans win, or in the legislature, if Republicans pick up a few more seats in each chamber, it's a non-zero possibility they could get a supermajority to override vetoes. So some of those laws probably would come into effect. What do you look at that you see as most significant if that were to happen?
You know, we could potentially put these laws into a couple of categories. Some of them involve the right to vote and the process for casting ballots. And the other is more about the mechanics of administering elections. So in terms of voting rights, there is a likelihood based on some of these bills that have already been introduced and vetoed that you would see some new limits on early and absentee voting. You might also see some increasingly aggressive purges of the voting rolls. And, you know, obviously there's good reason to want to have clean voter rolls, but if you purge too aggressively, it might mean that people who should be entitled to vote are not on the registration lists. So those are some of the changes that we might see in terms of, you know, how people vote. Then, you know, the administrative changes could also be a fairly big deal. You know, right now, elections in Wisconsin are administered by the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which is a body that the Republicans created in 2016 during the Walker administration, but they have soured on the Elections Commission since then. And so there is a lot of talk that the Elections Commission could be replaced entirely. You could have, depending on the outcome of the Secretary of State election, the legislature shift power over administering elections to the Secretary of State, or you could have the Elections Commission be overhauled in some way. Right now, it is a bipartisan body with three Democrats and three Republicans. And whatever, however it's changed would likely mean that it becomes a more partisan body, a body that is controlled either by the legislature or by the Republicans in some way who are aligned with the legislature.
Right. Candidate Tim Michaels at one point suggested changing that 3-3, the current makeup, which leads to a lot of deadlocks, Democrats and Republicans, with one representative per congressional district based on partisan control of that congressional district. Because of the way voters cluster in Wisconsin, because of the way the political maps are drawn, that would mean a Republican majority.
That's right. I mean, five of the eight representatives to Congress from Wisconsin right now are Republicans. It's likely to be five or six after this election. You know, in some ways, that proposal actually imports gerrymandering into the process of administering elections, because choices about how we draw those congressional districts are now going to matter for how Wisconsin's elections would be administered as well.
We are talking about voting the way we vote, the way campaigns are managed in Wisconsin, and why those things are at stake in this November's election here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in with your thoughts, changes you'd like to see, changes you'd hate to see, questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I think we have so many problems with our elections due to gerrymandering, incumbency, lack of term limits, and a lack of direct democracy. I firmly believe, given the legislatures that we have had for the last decade plus, we need to eliminate the legislature, have a drafting body prepare proposed laws, and simply allow them to go to statewide referendum, single issue, one thing at a time, and have monthly, everybody votes on the 10th on whatever proposal it may be. We don't need to pay these people. They don't represent me, and they don't represent you, and they're just, they're not doing their job.
Tom, thanks for the call. I want to ask you two things about Tom's comments, Rob. First of all, on the practical side of it, we don't even have statewide referenda as some other states to turn to on issues, except for constitutional amendments, a slight asterisk there. This would be a pretty tall order, a big change that Tom is calling for here.
That it would be a huge change. I mean, I don't think that eliminating the legislature is in the cards. I will say the majority of states, 26 of them, do have a referendum and or ballot initiative procedure that gives the people a more direct say over legislation. Wisconsin doesn't have that. The governor called a special session earlier this month, and the idea of that special session was to get the legislature to pass a direct democracy constitutional amendment proposal. That didn't happen. I imagine that this is something that's going to continue to get attention in the coming years. The trick in Wisconsin is that in order to amend the Constitution, that constitutional amendment process needs to begin in the legislature.
And aside from the practicality, what I hear in Tom's argument there is frustration with the legislature. And I think in different partisan quarters, there is a lot of frustration with how our government works.
Absolutely. And Tom mentioned gerrymandering in particular, and that has been a persistent issue in Wisconsin for over a decade now. It's a reason why, even though our statewide elections tend to swing back and forth, the legislature has remained, very firmly in Republican hands. And the median member of the legislature, the things that those legislators are trying to do aren't always representative of what a majority of Wisconsinites would want. So there is, a representational mismatch that happens as a result of that gerrymandering.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Michael now in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. Echoing some of the previous caller's sentiments, I wanted to express my frustration in, the suite of various pieces of legislation, predominantly by Republicans across the country, but including in Wisconsin, to restrict voting, whether it's making it harder to vote, requiring IDs to vote, which require people to have transportation and time and et cetera. But in generally just restricting voting, I feel that it's undemocratic. And, like the previous caller said, with gerrymandering, and like the guest was saying, since 2011, despite the fact that a number of elections that are statewide have gone for Democratic candidates, since 2011, Republicans have had a majority block in the legislature. And it's just very frustrating because, like you said, there's not a whole lot we can do about it directly.
Michael, thanks for the call. To Michael's first point, Robert, do we see an impact from some of the measures that Michael is talking about, supported by Republicans, to suppressing votes or creating obstacles for voters?
You know, this is really hard to study empirically because you don't really have controlled experiments that you're able to run for the most part. And so, you know, there have been some political scientists that have tried to pin down exactly what the effect on turnout might be, say, of a voter ID law. And in some cases, they do find at least some evidence of some suppression that's taking place. Even if people are able to get around some of these obstacles, the fact that they have to invest the time and resources to do it, you might say, is itself a problem, that people shouldn't have to jump through those hoops. And, you know, what you're really seeing around the country is a little bit of a bifurcation in terms of the right to vote. You see some states, mostly blue states, where voting rights are being expanded, where you have automatic voter registration, where you have vote by mail being more prevalent than ever. And then you have other states, and it's mostly red states, that are passing laws to restrict voting in various ways. And then, you know, you have some swing states like Wisconsin, states with divided control, where we actually have not seen any meaningful legislation passed in the last couple of years. But, you know, as you indicated at the beginning, depending on the outcome of the races this fall, we may see more movement come 2023.
We're talking to Rob Yablon, professor of law, director of the State Democracy Research Initiative, looking at what's at stake for election laws in this year's midterms in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a change on the table that Republicans have proposed in Wisconsin that you want to see become law? Do you think some of these changes could help clarify how we vote and maybe keep us from ending up in the courts on so many things? What do you hope to see? What do you worry about? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Rob Yablon, Associate Professor of Law and Director of the State Democracy Research Initiative at UW-Madison, looking at how election laws could change depending on the outcome of the midterm elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls now. Nathan is with us in Milwaukee. Nathan, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. One change that I would possibly look forward to is bringing back the GAB, or Government Accountability Board, only this time in order to get rid of it, require a referendum by the voters in order to do so, so that the people it's looking after actually have a say on if it stays or goes. In the moment, though, I think the bipartisan board is probably the best that we can get, so that it keeps both parties from not only running roughshod over the other voters, but everybody else who's not a party member. And I did find it concerning that Michaels, when he was talking about in the debate, said the legislature represents the people, when the problem is it should, but doesn't really do that now. And I, as a voter, would want my vote to be respected. I'm one of the hundreds of thousands of people who they wanted my ballot thrown out after the 2020 election because it was by mail. And the lawyer that argued to have that happen has been hired by Ron Johnson, so I would not be surprised if some ridiculous efforts pop up again.
Nathan, thanks for the call. First of all, the Government Accountability Board, the predecessor of our current election commission, Rob, made up mainly of retired judges, as I recall. Was that a better model, do you think, than what we have now?
You know, there were a lot of folks who study election administration that thought that the Government Accountability Board was, you know, one of the best election administrative agencies in the country. It was politically insulated, pretty nonpartisan. And so we shifted from that in 2016 to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which at least is bipartisan. But because you have this 3-3 split, it means that the commission is often deadlocked and can't issue decisions on things where local clerks, for example, would really like to have some guidance. And so, you know, we've seen, I think, what a lot of election people who study election administration would see as a backward shift. We've gone from a nonpartisan administrative body to a bipartisan body, and now there are proposals to really make election administration a partisan activity. And that, you know, when you administer elections, it's normally thought to be a good idea to have guardrails in place to ensure that partisan actors who are self-interested aren't able to wholly control the process. But that does seem to be the direction that we're moving.
Thanks for the call, Nathan. Dave joins us on the road. Dave, hi.
Yes, hi. I was calling because if I understood Rob right, he was stating that the legislative moves to change election laws have been the result of partisan interests. I was wondering if the legislature has actually held any open public hearings on these proposed changes before they adopt these laws that tend to get vetoed by Governor Evers, because right now he seems to be the only safeguard that we have.
Dave, thanks for the call. Rob, public input on these proposed changes, how much do we tend to see?
You know, we see some, and you know what the legislature will say is that, you know, they won't say that they're doing this for partisan reasons, but they'll say that they have real concerns about fraud, that they want to ensure election integrity, and that those are their motivations. You know, I think if you talk to a lot of the experts that study this and you look at the actual proposals that they're making, especially when it comes to election administration, you see that these are proposals that are removing rather than adding guardrails to the system.
Dave, thanks for the call. Martha joins us now in Rhinelander. Martha, hi.
Hi. I'd like to know what the gentleman thinks of getting rid of the Electoral College. The pros and cons. I personally think if we have one person, one vote, there'd be a lot less corruptible steps. But what does the gentleman think?
Martha, thanks for the call. And there is, Rob, an active effort in some states, a national popular vote compact, an effort to get around having to change the Constitution that would, in effect, make the popular vote winner the winner of the presidential race. Your thoughts on pros and cons there?
Well, you know, there is a lot to be said for just having a straightforward national election where the president is the person that gets the most votes nationally. I mean, we think of the president as someone who's supposed to represent the country as the whole. So, you know, in those instances where someone becomes president despite having fewer votes, there is a little bit of an oddity to that. And, you know, having the Electoral College affects the way that presidential campaigns are run in some strange ways. It means that all of the attention tends to get focused on swing states and swing areas. A lot of places in the country largely get ignored during presidential campaigns. And so there is a lot to be said for reforming it. The trick is, how do you do it? A constitutional amendment is obviously a very heavy lift. You mentioned the possibility of this interstate compact. In order for that to kick in, you would essentially need states that represent a majority of the Electoral College to sign on. But there are a lot of states that feel like they're served pretty well by the current system, including swing states like Wisconsin. You know, we are among the states that get more attention than we otherwise might. And so it might be a tough sell to get a state like Wisconsin on board with that kind of reform.
Martha, thanks for that call. Rob, I wanted to ask about the impact of election denial. We've got people still claiming that the 2020 presidential election didn't come out the way that it did. We have some candidates, Republican candidates around the country, not as much I've heard here in Wisconsin, people saying if they lose, it is therefore fraudulent, saying basically broadcasting that they're not going to accept the election results unless they win. How big a deal is that?
It is discouraging that this has persisted now for 2 years since the 2020 election, despite the fact that there have been, you know, dozens of judicial rulings around the country that have rejected claims relating to the 2020 election, despite, you know, multiple reviews. This is probably the most scrutinized presidential election in history, and none of these conspiracy theories have panned out. You know, the fact that nevertheless you see this strand of election denialism is unfortunate. And it's hard to know how this will play out after 2022. You know, it's possible that if the candidates who are the strongest election deniers lose some key races, particularly races that might have been winnable by, say, a more mainstream Republican candidate, that the Republican Party might start to do more to distance itself from election denialism and it could gradually fade. But it's also possible that it goes the other way. I mean, it's sort of sort of strange to think about what might happen if some of these candidates win. On one hand, it'll be harder for them to claim that the system is rigged against them if they've prevailed under that system. But at the same time, once they're in office, they're likely to follow through with many of the changes in the law that they've been talking about.
In just our last minute and a half or so, Rob, I mentioned a lot of lawsuits. What are you watching here in Wisconsin, either in terms of voting lawsuits that have been resolved or that might still be in the works?
Right. Well, you know, we have already had a lot of litigation in Wisconsin, more than you'd normally expect to see in a midterm. A lot of this is about absentee voting protocols. There have been lawsuits challenging guidance that the Wisconsin Elections Commission has issued, arguing that it's contrary to Wisconsin statutes. And there have been changes to absentee voting rules I think it's a challenging time for local clerks to try to administer the election because some of these rules still seem to be in flux. If the initial count after Election Day in Wisconsin is close, we're very likely to see more election about more litigation about some of these issues and others. You know, in Wisconsin, candidates are entitled to a recount if the margin is less than 1%. And that happens regularly in Wisconsin. It happened in both the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections. It almost happened in the 2018 governor's race. Governor Evers won that race by just 1.1%. And so if we're within that recount margin, I expect that we're going to see some quite aggressive litigation after the election.
Is there a hope, just briefly, Rob, that if we get things resolved in courts now and clarity on how those votes are handled, that might preempt some of that?
You know, it is possible to some extent, but there are still issues that look like they're not going to be fully resolved when it comes to absentee ballot rules. For example, there are likely to still be some lingering disputes about what happens if there are some imperfections on an absentee ballot witness certification where the address is mostly filled out but not completely filled out. There still, unfortunately, is going to be plenty that could be litigated after the election.
Rob, thanks again for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
That's Robert Yablon, Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director of the State Democracy Research Initiative at UW-Madison. He joined us today to talk about how election laws became a big issue in this year's midterm elections. Still time for you to join in with your questions. If there's something else you want to know about elections, we can maybe tackle them in a future show or pass them along to the news team. Email ideas@WPR.org. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, nature has a rich audio soundtrack. New technology is helping us humans hear and understand it better and better. Find out more with the author of the new book, The Sounds of Life, tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a look at choose your own adventure books and stories. I have some nostalgic memories, and they've made a comeback. Join the conversation about choose your own adventures as storytelling. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, left-leaning comedy had a solid run as the more popular form of political comedy on television and other platforms. But recent years have seen a rise in more conservative and or libertarian comedy content. The conservative-leaning talk show Gutfeld on Fox News has strong ratings on late-night TV, and The Joe Rogan Experience is one of the most popular podcasts in the U.S. Our next guest says left and right-leaning comedy have significant influences on the political landscape, and people on either side of the aisle shouldn't ignore the opposite side's comedy, even if they don't find it funny. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch or listen to political comedy? Do you like comedy in your politics? Do you think that comedians have an impact on people's political views, maybe even on how they vote? What kind of stuff do you watch, listen to, you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Marks is an associate professor of film and media studies at Colorado State University. He's co-author of the new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. He's also a Wisconsin native and graduate of UW-Madison. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You talk in the book about a big divide, I think even an awareness of conservative comedy, and that's probably true among listeners. I know we have, we just did a segment on late night TV a couple weeks back. We have Greg Gutfeld fans out there, people who listen to or watch the things you talk about in your book. And then there are people who are oblivious, or maybe just seen the name, don't know what it's all about. Can you talk about that divide even in knowing this exists?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the major goals of the book is simply to make our fellow liberals aware that conservatives are doing comedy successfully. They're economically profitable. They get TV ratings, as you just mentioned, in the case of Gutfeld. And this comedy has the potential to recruit new members to conservative causes in much the same way that political satire functioned on the left through figures like Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Samantha Bee, and others over the years.
Right.
The interesting thing we found was that a lot of our fellow liberals were simply oblivious or didn't know about this robust world of right-wing comedy that we describe in the book for a whole host of reasons.
Yeah, your book is, in effect, a tour of conservative political comedy for a liberal audience, I think, to understand it. I want to go back to a moment where I think a lot of the people you're talking to may have stopped paying attention, where, you know, you had The Daily Show and its various spinoffs and imitators, and there were conservative efforts on Fox News and elsewhere to replicate that, to create the conservative Daily Show, and they failed. And some of the people you talk to in the book, and you quote critics and others saying, aha, this means liberals can be funny in this political way and conservatives can't. But then what happened?
That's right. The example of Fox News's 2007 failed Daily Show, the half-hour news hour, is often cited by our fellow liberal media researchers and political communication scholars as evidence that, well, the right tried to make a Daily Show back in 2007, and it failed. And admittedly, it was quite bad if you go back and watch episodes. And it's still held up as evidence today that conservatives can't be funny, that they don't have the psychology, they don't have the taste in order to create comedy. We think that's being willfully blind to the multitude of not only different comedy forms that are out there today, but the platforms that deliver it across our social media feeds, across established TV channels like Fox News and others. So to simply go back 15 years and say, well, yeah, conservatives tried this and it wasn't very good, therefore they're still unable to do it, to me, simply rings false.
And let's talk about Greg Gutfeld now, a central figure in your book. Fox News went from, I think, a 3 a.m. show to a weekend late night show to every weekend night and doing quite well with it in the ratings. Where do you position him in the world of conservative leaning comedy on Fox News?
Yeah, so Gutfeld is very much one of the faces, if not the face, of late night on Fox News today. He gets his start doing a, frankly, experimental comedy show called Red Eye for years in the early to mid 2000s, where it was a pretty conventional sort of news talk show, but he'd often have on stand-up comedians, writers, people who were inclined to have a satiric, ironic take on the news. He moves into a Saturday slot in 2015, the Greg Gutfeld Show. This show begins to attract eyeballs, especially with the start of the Trump presidency and the sort of comedic modes of address that Trump brought into his presidential term. Such was Gutfeld's success that by 2021, Fox News moved him to a nightly show directly opposite The Daily Show to compete with that show. And it was routinely beating not only that liberal satire show on Comedy Central, but also the late night broadcast stalwarts of Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon, and Jimmy Kimmel.
One key thing here is we have so many options of what to watch that a niche comedy show, if it can connect with the right audience, whether The Daily Show did with a more liberal, younger audience, or Gutfeld can at the end of the day on Fox News with a built-in conservative audience, that's something we might not have been able to do when you had three choices late at night. You had to have a big tent and bring in as many viewers as possible.
It's a great point. And part of the sort of story we tell in the book is one of a move from a broadcast era with three channels into a sort of, you know, divided up cable era towards the end of the 90s, into the 2000s, to today, where media platforms more or less serve us in hyper individualistic taste circles, right? And it is content producers like Fox News, like Joe Rogan, the platforms like Spotify, it's their mission to kind of find these very, very small accumulations of audiences and aggregate them in political affiliation, demographic similarities, so that the measure of success, maybe getting 500,000 people to watch your show, is radically smaller today than it was even 5, 10 years ago. this is the sort of media industry environment that's allowed something as seemingly unthinkable as conservative comedy to not only rise up, but to flourish wholly unnoticed by so many folks on the left.
Talking to Nick Marks, co-author of the book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Seth is with us in Sparta. Seth, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Seth?
Hey, you know, so in regards to, you know, the left and the right and what's funny and what's not and who can have a sense of humor and who can't have a sense of humor, you know, at the end of the day, we're all human and we're all Americans. And, you know, you got to look at, you know, both sides of the aisle, because, you know, you might be a conservative and you might find some liberal dudes who are super funny. And, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, we're all not going to get out of this alive, so you might as well do it when I can.
Seth, thanks for the call. Now, Nick, I know you're hoping that people at least be aware of the political comedy happening on the other side of the aisle. Can you talk about the value of that?
Yeah, part of it is absolutely an acknowledgement of our shared humanity. So it is a basic human impulse to laugh. And importantly, laughter has really powerful affiliative bonds. It brings us closer together with other human beings. We so rarely are in the same room with other people that we don't know laughing at the same thing, right? You think of what you used to do going to the movies to see, a Jim Carrey or a Will Ferrell movie back in the day. And you didn't know most of the people in that dark movie theater. Today, comedy is not as much of a sort of bonding mechanism across difference. Today, comedy is much more likely to bond you with somebody who's already inclined to think like you, to laugh at the same thing as you, and you're unlikely to encounter someone who's politically, you know, divergent from you and share in that bonding power of laughter like we once were 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Seth, thanks for that call. Now, Nick, I don't want to ignore what ends up being the dark side of the book here. You know, one end of a conservative comedy political spectrum might be somebody making fun of a Democratic president, Democratic politicians. Not too out of the ordinary, really. But there's an ecosystem here that goes from there to some, as you tapped into, some really dark places. Can you connect the dots for us a little?
That's right. So the other sort of major argument we make in the book is that the sort of mainstream faces many folks might be familiar with, Greg Gutfeld, Joe Rogan, are connected and intentionally connect with more sort of malevolent voices further and further right on the political spectrum. So while listening to an episode of the Joe Rogan Experience itself might not be a sort of political act or a right-wing act, Joe Rogan frequently has on libertarian comedians like the stand-up comedian Dave Smith, who then goes on somebody else's podcast or a talk show, who's got some ideas about race science or about what we should do with folks at the border. These connections are made clear for listeners and users via social media algorithms, right? So the more that you click on, like, comment on, engage with one of these comedians, the likelier Facebook, Twitter, and others are to connect you to folks further and further down into the sort of dark layer of trolls. And frankly, folks like Gavin McInnes, the Proud Boys founder, is a prominent figure we talk about in the book. So it's not that the immediate act of watching Gutfeld, listening to Rogan, is itself a bad thing, but it can lead to much more bad faith and evil actors the more you engage with this world.
We're talking to media studies professor Nick Marks about his new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like political comedy that you agree with? Do you avoid political comedy that you don't agree with? Do you have a favorite figure, past or present, who treats politics broadly defined in a humorous way? Do you have a question for our guest about his book and his work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nick Marks, media studies professor at Colorado State University, co-author of the new book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them. He's with us today to talk about the role comedy plays in politics, how the landscape has shifted in recent years, offering a tour of conservative comedy, especially for the unfamiliar. You could join in whether you're familiar with it or not. 800-642-1234. Where do you go for political humor? Or do you just not find politics funny? Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Beth is with us in Beaver Dam. Beth, hi.
Hi. For 25 years, I've enjoyed watching The View. So back in the day, I would record it on a VCR, and today I watch it on my phone. My favorite commentator is Joy Behar, who is a comedian, and Whoopi Goldberg, the moderator, is also a comedian. And they always have one conservative host, and they don't seem to last. It's kind of like a revolving door. And then if you read the comments or critics, the attitude for them is towards them is murderous, so critical in whatever that they say.
Interesting. Beth, thanks for the call. Nick, outside of your book a little bit, but your thoughts on The View and political comedy.
No, I think it's a great example that both Joy and Whoopi are stand-up comedians. That's where they made their name. And that show, when it's at its best, is funny, or it's having sort of satiric takes on the news of the day. I will say that the Meghan McCain chair that she filled for years is intentional, right? I don't know that that show is as sort of balanced as it makes itself out to be, but it makes for great television to have her sort of be the sort of face of disagreement to the majority sort of liberal panelists on that show.
Thanks for that call. Jim joins us now in Milwaukee. Jim, hi.
Hello. I think The View, I'm funny you brought that up. I think The View supplies more comedy just by their hypocrisy. I mean, the show has a certain sense of comedy, and they do target conservatives. But most of the comedy comes afterwards when you hear the hypocrisy of what they say. And just with a little bit of analysis, it really makes the left look bad. And I do listen to public radio, and I listen to some conservative talk shows. And I got to say, the comedy is really on the conservative side. There's just so much material out there. And I do not know why any of the late night shows are, they don't make any attempts at Biden. They don't make any attempts at, just the hypocrisy that goes on with their policies. That's what I see.
Jim, thanks for the call. Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, it is. It's a valid point generally that many of our television liberal comedians have gone soft in recent years. The function of folks like Colbert, the folks on The View, and others has been less and less to make us laugh, especially in the Trump era, and more to be a sort of soothing presence to say, they're there, the orange man is bad, he'll be gone soon, and we'll get back to life as normal. Well, now that he's gone, those shows haven't necessarily gone back to being as funny and sort of transgressive as they were in a previous era. That's got a whole host of factors behind it, but the main one is I think those shows just aren't in the business of making us laugh anymore. They're too sort of broadly general entertainment based. And I think there's something to that caller's point that this mantle of edgy, experimental sometimes comedy is very much being taken up by folks on the right, where folks on the left have been vacating that space.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steven joins us now in Milwaukee. Steven, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
What did you want to bring up, Steven?
I want to bring the fact that, you know, I'm a liberal, and I'm also a comedian. I've been a comedian comedy in the past, and I feel like it's a catch-22 where it's like, yeah, okay, you know, you can, you know, Joe Rogan and all this kind of stuff, yeah, which I do annoys me and stuff like that, but it's also like, Jon Stewart also insulted people, too. They insult people, and they have on people, and they're both spectrums. It's like, we're all human beings. Comedy should just be comedy. And I think that when you – and I do think the left side gets too butthurt about, like, their comedy, because it's like, oh, my God, you said this, they said that, and they get so offended so quickly. When comedy is comedy – and I do agree with what the talker was saying about, like, yes, to lead things on the path. But, I mean, we are adults here, right? I mean, you can choose to think, like, I watch everything and I, you know, laugh at everything.
I gotcha, Stephen. Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, there is, comedy is comedy. But part of our analysis in the book is pointing out how there's very little money to be made by comedians from just sort of trying to please all sides, from trying to do this very broad general audience-based joking. Instead, the thing that algorithms push to the top of our feed, the thing that advertisers want to pay for, is stuff further and further in either direction. Extremity, right? Polarity is what sort of drives not only our political discourse, but what drives profitable cultural products like podcasts and late night talk shows too.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to get into one particular part of your book, Nick, in the darker part of a conservative humor, I guess, conservative comedy. Some of the trolling that goes on, with literally to the extreme of people making jokes about the Holocaust. And then when people respond, well, that's the joke. I managed to make you respond to this horrific thing I said. Can you talk about that trolling edge here?
Yeah, strangely enough, this is the form of right-wing humor that many liberals are perhaps familiar with, because it's such a familiar part of sort of online discourse and online culture. What you see on the right in figures like Gavin McInnes and Nick Fuentes and some of the, well, out and out Nazi podcasts that we researched for the book is, again, an economic incentive to go where other comedians would not go. So folks see that, Tim Allen is occupying this sitcom dad version of conservative comedy, and Joe Rogan is the libertarian sort of mouthpiece of the right wing. While some of the other further right trolling voices we identify say, hey, what if we went a step beyond all of those folks? All we have to do is garner an audience that's a fraction of theirs, and we can stay profitable and hope to take the next step up the next rung of the ladder to try to get more and more exposure.
And finally, Nick, one thing that kind of bugs me about a lot of political comedy, left or right, is that, okay, I have a show, I know my audience agrees with my perspective, whether it's a left or right show. I make a joke that makes fun of the other side, and they're going to laugh at it. It's like a 90s comic being at a convention of people who hate airline food. Like, you've got this built-in audience. You say comfortable things. We all agree. Does it really make a difference when that happens?
Yeah. Tina Fey and Seth Meyers famously call this comedy clapter. I think it's pretty prominent in things like the current iteration of The Daily Show, or a host simply says, oh, Mitch McConnell, he's bad. And there's not really a joke. It's just sort of a cheap Mitch McConnell impersonation. So the short answer is no. I don't believe that version of comedy is making a political impact. What I think is happening in the case of right-wing comedy, at least, is it's drawing in especially younger men who may be politically undecided or ambivalent. And it gets them thinking in the political realm, then introduces them to more and more avowedly political ideas of the libertarian ilk or whatever. So that initial encounter might not be a political act, but it gets politically ambivalent, especially younger folks, thinking further and further down the line. And we're saying that right now comedy is serving this function in a right-wing manner.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Nick Marks, Associate Professor of Film and Media Studies at Colorado State University. He's co-author of the book, That's Not Funny, How the Right Makes Comedy Work for Them, with us today looking at shifts in political comedy over the years and how that can influence the political landscape as a whole. Still interested in data from you, or a datum from you, as we heard on the Grammar Show this week? Let us know. Do you seek out political comedy? Who do you watch? Who do you avoid? Or do you avoid it as a genre? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, control of Congress is at stake in November, with big issues like abortion, election law, and a whole lot more at stake. We'll look at the state of the race to control the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, and what could swing things one way or another, whether it's issues, the economy, and more. And fall is a great time for some homemade comfort food. On this week's edition of Food Friday, a Wisconsin cook brings us some home cooking comfort with great ingredients and recipes for the time and place. You can let us know your favorite comfort food to make at home. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.